of the doctor, the commandant, and the commissar, as they stood around me, no longer in lab coats, scrubs, and stainless steel goggles, but in yellow uniforms with red tabs of rank, pistols holstered on their hips. While those below were human and ghost, I was the supernatural Holy Spirit, clairvoyant and clairaudient. In this detached way, I saw the commandant kneel down and reach his hand toward my subhuman self, index finger slowly extending until it pressed lightly on my open eyeball, a touch at which my poor body flinched. Myself. Please let me sleep. The commandant. You can sleep when I'm satisfied with your confession. Myself. But I've done nothing. The commandant. Exactly. Myself. The lights are too bright. If you could... The commandant. The world watched what happened to our country, and most of the world did nothing. Not only that, they also took great pleasure in it. You are no exception. Myself. I spoke out, didn't I? Is it my fault no one listened? The commandant. Don't make excuses. We didn't whine. We were all willing to be martyrs. It's only pure luck that the doctor, the commissar, and myself are alive. You simply weren't willing to sacrifice yourself to save the agent, though she was willing to sacrifice her life to save the commissar's. Myself. No, I. The commandant, the commissar, and the doctor, in unison. Admit it! I saw myself admit it then. I heard myself acknowledge that I was not being punished or re-educated for the things I had done, but for the thing I had not done. I wept and cried without shame for the shame I felt. I was guilty of the crime of doing nothing. I was the man to whom things are done because he had done nothing. And not only did I weep and cry, I howled, a tornado of feeling causing the windows of my soul to shudder and clack. The sight and sound of my abjection was so disturbing that everyone averted his eyes from the sorry mess I had made of myself, except for the commandant, the commissar, and I. The commissar. Satisfied? The commandant. So he has admitted to doing nothing. But what about the brew comrade and the watchman? The commissar. He couldn't have done anything to save the brew comrade and the watchman. As for the agent, she lived. The commandant. She couldn't even walk when we liberated her. The commissar. Perhaps she was broken in body, but not in spirit. The doctor. What happened to those policemen? The commissar. I found them. The commandant. They paid the price. Shouldn't he? The commissar. Yes, but he should also receive credit for the lives he took. The commandant. Sonny and the major... Their pitiful lives aren't even equal to the agent's injuries. The commissar. But is his father's life equal? My father? What was this? Even Sonny and the crapulent major, appalled at the harsh evaluation of their lives and deaths, paused in their agitation to listen. The commandant. What did he do to his father? The commissar. Ask him yourself. Commandant. You, look at me. What did you do to your father? Myself. I didn't do anything to my father. The commandant and the commissar and the doctor, in unison. Admit it! And looking down on my weeping, yoked self, I did not know whether I should laugh or cry in sympathy. Did I not remember what I had written to man about my father? I wish he were dead. Myself. But I didn't mean it. The commissar. Be honest with yourself. Myself. I didn't mean for you to do it. The commissar. Of course you did. Who did you think you were writing to? I was writing to the revolutionary who was on a powerful committee and who knew even then that he might one day be a commissar. I was writing to a political cadre already learning the plastic art of making over the souls and minds of men. I was writing to a friend who would do whatever I asked. I was writing to a writer who valued the force of a sentence and the weight of a word. I was writing to a brother who knew what I wanted more than I knew it myself. The commandant and the commissar and the doctor in unison. What did you do? Myself. I wanted him dead. The commandant rubbed his chin and looked doubtfully at the doctor, who shrugged. The doctor only cracked open bodies and minds. He was not responsible for what he found. The doctor. How did his father die? The commissar. A bullet in the head, listening to his assassin's confession. The commandant. I wouldn't put it past you to make up this story to save him. The commissar. Ask my agent. She arranged the father's death. The commandant gazed down at me. If I could be guilty of doing nothing, shouldn't I also be deserving of wanting something? In this case, my father's death? This father, in the commandant's atheistic mind, was a colonizer, a dealer in the opiate of the masses, a spokesman for a god for whom millions of dark-skinned people had been sacrificed, supposedly for their own salvation, a burning cross lighting their hard road to heaven. His death was not murder, but just a sentence, which was all that I had ever wanted to write. The commandant. I'll think about it. The commandant turned and departed, the doctor obediently following, leaving Sonny and the crapulent major to watch as the commissar slowly settled into the chair with a grimace. The commissar. What a pair we are. Myself. Turn off the lights. I can't see. The commissar. What is more precious than independence and freedom? Myself. Happiness? The commissar. What is more precious than independence and freedom? Myself. Love? The commissar. What is more precious than independence and freedom? Myself. I don't know. The commissar. What is more precious than independence and freedom? Myself. I wish I was dead. There, I had said it, sobbing and howling. Now, at last, I knew what it was I wanted for myself, what so many people wanted for me. Sonny and the crapulent major applauded in approval, while the commissar drew his pistol. At last, death would hurt only for a moment, which was not as bad as when one considered how much and for how long life hurt. The sound of the bullet loading into the chamber was as clear as the bell of my father's church, which my mother and I heard from our hovel every Sunday morning. Looking down on myself, I could still see the child in the man and the man in the child. I was ever always divided, although it was only partially my fault. While I chose to live two lives and be a man of two minds, it was not hard to, given how people had always called me a bastard. Our country itself was cursed, bastardized, partitioned into north and south, and if it could be said of us that we chose division and death in our own uncivil war, that was only partially true. We had not chosen to be debased by the French, to be divided by them into an unholy trinity of north, center, and south, to be turned over to the great powers of capitalism and communism for a further bisection, then given roles as the clashing armies of a Cold War chess match, played in air-conditioned rooms by white men wearing suits and lies. No, just as my abused generation was divided before birth, so was I divided on birth, delivered into a postpartum world where hardly anyone accepted me for who I was, but only ever bullied me into choosing between my two sides. This was not simply hard to do, no, it was truly impossible. For how could I choose me against myself? Now my friend would release me from this small world, with its small-minded people, those mobs who treated a man with two minds and two faces as a freak, who wanted only one answer for any question. But wait, what was he doing? He had put the gun on the floor and knelt by my side, untying the sack around my right hand, then untying the rope binding it. I saw myself holding my hand before my eyes, scored with the red mark of our brotherhood. Through those subhuman eyes and through my supernatural gaze above, I saw my friend place the pistol in my hand. A Tokarev. The Soviets had based their design on the American Colt, and while its weight was not unfamiliar, I could not hold the pistol upright on my own, forcing my friend to wrap my fingers around the grip. The commissar. You are the only one who can do this for me. Will you? And here he leaned forward, pressing the muzzle between his eyes, his hand steadying my own. Myself. Why are you doing this? As I spoke, I cried. He, too, wept, tears rolling down the hideous absence of a face that I had not seen this close in years. Where was the brother of my youth, vanished from everywhere except my memory? There, and only there, his earnest face remained, serious and idealistic, with high, pronounced cheekbones, thin, narrow lips, an aristocratic, slim nose, and an expansive brow hinting at a powerful intelligence whose tidal force had worn away the hairline. All that was left to be recognized were the eyes, kept alive by tears, and the timbre of his voice. The Commissar. I'm crying because I can hardly bear to see you so afflicted. But I cannot save you except to have you afflicted. The Commandant would not have it otherwise. At this I laughed, although the body on the mattress only trembled. Myself. How is this saving me? He smiled through his tears. I recognized the smile, too, the whitest I had ever seen among any of my people, befitting a dentist's son. What had changed was not the smile, but the face, or the lack of it, so that this white smile floated in a void, the horrible grin of a Cheshire cat. The Commissar. We are in an impossible situation. The Commandant will let you leave only when you redeem yourself. But what about Bonn? And even if he can leave, what will you two do? Myself. If Bonn can't leave, neither can I. The Commissar. And so you will die here. He pressed the barrel of the gun against his head even harder. The Commissar. Shoot me first, not because of my face. I would not die for its sake. I would only exile myself here so that my family need never see this thing again. But I would live. I was no longer my body or myself. I was only the gun, and through its steel came the vibrations of his word, signaling the impending arrival of a locomotive that would crush us both. The Commissar. I am the Commissar. But what kind of school do I oversee? One in which you, of all people, are re-educated. It is not because you did nothing that you are here. It is because you are too educated that you are being re-educated. But what have you learned? Myself. I watched and did nothing. The Commissar. I will tell you what cannot be found in any book. In every town, village, and ward, the cadres deliver the same lectures. They reassure those citizens not in re-education of our good intentions. But the committees and the commissars do not care about remaking these prisoners. Everyone knows this, and no one will say it aloud. All the jargon that the cadres spout only hides an awful truth. Myself. I wanted my father dead. The Commissar. Now that we are powerful, we don't need the French or the Americans to fuck us over. We can fuck ourselves just fine. The glare above my body was blinding. I was no longer certain whether I could see everything or nothing, and under the heat of the lights my palm was slick with perspiration. My grip on the pistol was slippery, but the Commissar's hands held the barrel in place. The Commissar, if anyone besides you knew that I had spoken the unspeakable, I would be re-educated. But it is not re-education that I fear. It is the education I have that terrifies me. How can a teacher live teaching something he does not believe in? How do I live seeing you like this? I cannot. Now, pull the trigger. I think I said that I would rather shoot myself first, but I could not hear myself, and when I tried to pull the gun away from his head and turn it toward my own, I did not have the strength. Those relentless eyes stared down at me, now dry as bones, and from somewhere deep inside of him came a rumble. Then the rumble burst forth, and he was laughing. What was so funny? This black comedy? No, that was too heavy. This illuminated room allowed for only a light comedy. A white comedy where one would die from laughter. Not that he laughed that long. He stopped laughing when he let go of my hand, my arm dropping to my side and the pistol clattering on the cement floor. Behind the Commissar, Sonny and the crapulent major stared with longing at the Tokarev. Either one would have been happy to pick it up and shoot me if he could, but they no longer possessed their bodies. As for the Commissar and I, we had bodies but could not shoot, and perhaps that made the Commissar laugh. The void that had been his face still loomed above me. His hilarity having passed with such rapidity, I was not sure I had heard correctly. I thought I saw sadness in that void, but I could not be certain. Only the eyes and teeth expressed any emotion, and he no longer cried or smiled. The Commissar. I apologize. That was selfish and weak of me. If I died, you would die and then Bon. The Commandant can't wait to drag him before the firing squad. At least now you can save yourself and our friend, if not me. That I can live with. Myself. Please, can we talk of this after I sleep? The Commissar. First answer my question. Myself. But why? The Commissar holstered his pistol. Then he tied my free hand down once more and stood up. He gazed down on me from a great height, and perhaps it was because of the foreshortened angle, but I saw in his absence of a face something else besides horror, a faint shadow cast by madness, although perhaps it was merely an ocular effect created by the glare behind his head. The Commissar, my friend, the Commandant may let you go because you wanted your father dead, but I will let you go only when you can answer my question. Just remember, my brother, that I do this for your own good. He raised his hand to me in farewell, and on his palm blazed the red mark of our oath. With that, he left. Those are the most dangerous words you can hear, Sonny said, sitting down on the vacated chair. The crapulent major joined him, pushing him aside the room. For your own good can only mean something bad, he said. As if on cue, the speakers mounted high in the corners clicked and hummed. The ones I had only noticed when the Commissar played for me my own stranger's voice. The question of what would be done to me was answered when somebody began screaming, and while Sonny and the crapulent major could clap their hands over their ears, I could not. But even with ears protected, Sonny and the crapulent major could not endure the screaming for more than a minute, the shrieking of a baby in torment, and in the blink of an eye, they too vanished. Somewhere a baby was screaming, its suffering shared with me, who needed no more. I saw myself squeeze my eyes shut, as if that could also squeeze my ears shut. It was impossible to think with the screaming in this examination room, and for the first time in a very long time I wanted something more than sleep. I wanted silence. Oh, please, I heard myself crying this aloud. Stop! Then another click, and the screaming ceased. A tape. I was listening to a tape. No baby was being tortured in some nearby chamber, its howl piped into mine. It was just a recording. And for a few moments, I only had to worry about the unceasing light and heat and the rubber band snap of the electric wire against my little toe. But then I heard the click again, and my body clenched in anticipation. Somebody began screaming once more. Somebody was screaming so loudly that I not only lost track of myself, I lost track of time. Time no longer ran straight as a railroad. Time no longer rotated on a dial. Time no longer crawled under my back. Time was infinitely looping, a cassette tape repeating without end. Time howled in my ear, screaming with laughter at the idea that we could control it with wristwatches, alarm clocks, revolutions, history. We were, all of us, running out of time, except for the malevolent baby. The baby who was screaming had all the time in the world, and the irony was that the baby didn't even know it. Please, I heard myself again. Stop. I'll do anything you want. How was it that the most vulnerable creature in the world could also be the most powerful? Did I scream like this at my mother? If so, forgive me, Mama. If I screamed, it was not because of you. I am one, but I am also two, made from an egg and a sperm, and if I screamed, it must be because of those blue genes gleaned from my father. I saw it now, that moment of my origin. The Chinese acrobat of time bent impossibly back on itself so that I could see the invasion of my mother's womb by my father's dumb, masculine horde, a howling gang of helmeted, hell-bent nomads intent on piercing the great wall of my mother's egg. From this invasion, the nothing that I was became the somebody that I am. Somebody was screaming, and it was not the baby. My cell divided and divided and divided again, until I was a million cells, and more, until I was multitudes and multitudes, my own country, my own nation, the emperor and dictator of the masses of myself, commanding my mother's undivided attention. Somebody was screaming, and it was the agent. I was packed tight into my mother's aquarium, knowing nothing of independence and freedom, witnessed by all my senses except the sense of sight, to the uncanniest experience of all, being inside another human being. I was a doll within a doll, hypnotized by a metronome ticking with perfect regularity, my mother's strong and steady heartbeat. Somebody was screaming, and it was my mother. Her voice was the first sound I heard when I emerged head first, thrust into a humid room as warm as a womb, seized by the gnarled hands of an unimpressed doula who would tell me, years later, how she had used her sharpened thumbnail to slice the titan frenulum holding down my tongue, the better for me to suckle and to talk. This was also the woman who told me, with glee, of how my mother pushed so hard she expelled not only me, but also the waste of her bowels, washing me onto the shores of a strange new world in a maternal effluence of blood and excrement. Somebody was screaming, and I did not know who it was. My leash was cut, and my naked, smeared purple self was turned toward a throbbing light, revealing me to a world of shadows and dim shapes, speaking my mother tongue, a foreign tongue. Somebody was screaming, and I knew who it was. It was me, screaming the one word that had dangled before me since the question was first asked. Nothing. The question that I could neither see nor hear until now. Nothing. The answer I screamed again and again and again, nothing, because I was, at last, enlightened. Chapter 23. With that one word, I completed my re-education. All that remains to be told is how I glued myself back together, and how I found myself where I am now, preparing for a watery departure from my country. Like everything else of consequence in my life, neither task was easy. Leaving, in particular, is not something that I want to do, but is something I must do. What in life is left for me, or any of the other graduates of re-education? No place exists for us in this revolutionary society, even for those who think of themselves as revolutionaries. We cannot be represented here, and this knowledge hurts more than anything done to me in my examination. Pain ends, but knowledge does not, at least until the mind rots away. And when would that ever happen to me, the man with two minds? The end of pain, at least, began when I spoke that one word. In retrospect, the answer was obvious. So why did it take me so long to understand? Why did I have to be educated and re-educated for so many years, and at such great expense to both the American taxpayer and the Vietnamese society? Not to mention considerable damage to myself, in order to see, at last, the word that was there at the very beginning. The answer was so absurd that now, months later, and in the temporary safety of the navigator's house, I laugh even as I reread this scene of my enlightenment, which itself devolved, or is it evolved, from screams to laughter. Of course, I was still screaming when the commissar came to turn off the light and sound. I was still screaming when he unbound me and embraced me, cradling my head against his breast until my scream subsided. "There, there," he said in the dark examination room, silent at last, except for my sobbing. "Now you know what I know, don't you?" "Yes," I said, sobbing still. "I get it. I get it." What was it that I got? The joke. Nothing was a punchline. And if part of me was rather hurt by being punched, by nothing, no less, the other part of me thought it was hilarious. That was why, as I shook and shuddered in that dark examination room, my wailing and sobbing turned to howls of laughter. I laughed so hard that eventually the baby-faced guard and the commandant came to investigate the cause of the commotion. "What's so funny?" the commandant demanded. "Nothing," I cried. I was at last broken. I had at last spoken. "Don't you get it?" I cried. "The answer is nothing, 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 nothing." Only the commissar understood what I meant. The commandant, flustered by my bizarre behavior, said, "Look what you've done to him. He's out of his mind." He was not so much concerned with me as he was about the camp's health, for a madman who kept on saying nothing would be bad for morale. I was mad that it had taken me so long to understand nothing, even though my failure, in hindsight, was inevitable. A good student cannot understand nothing. Only the class clown, the misunderstood idiot, the devious fool, and the perpetual joker can do that. Still, such a realization could not spare me from the pain of overlooking the obvious, the pain that drove me to push the commissar away, to beat my fist against my forehead. "Stop that," said the commandant. He turned to the baby-faced guard. "Stop him." The baby-faced guard struggled with me as I beat not only my fist against my forehead, but my head against the wall. Finally, the commissar and the commandant themselves had to help him tie me down again. Only the commissar understood that I had to beat myself. I was so stupid. How could I forget that every truth meant at least two things, that slogans were empty suits draped on the corpse of an idea? The suits depended on how one wore them, and this suit was now worn out. I was mad, but not insane, although I was not going to disabuse the commandant. He saw only one meaning in nothing, the negative, the absence, as in, there's nothing there. The positive meaning eluded him, the paradoxical fact that nothing is, indeed, something. Our commandant was a man who didn't get the joke, and people who do not get the joke are dangerous people indeed. They are the ones who say nothing with great piousness, who ask everyone else to die for nothing, who revere nothing. Such a man could not tolerate someone who laughed at nothing. "Satisfied?" he asked the commissar. Both of them looking down on me, sobbing, weeping, and laughing all at the same time. "Now we have to call in the doctor again." "Call him in, then," said the commissar. "The hard part's done." The doctor moved me back to my old isolation cell, although now the chamber was unlocked and I was not shackled. I was free to go as I pleased, but was reluctant to do so, sometimes needing the baby-faced guard to coax me out of the corners. Even on those rare occasions when I emerged voluntarily, it was never into sunlight, but only the night, a conjunctivitis having rendered my eyes sensitive to the solarized world. The doctor prescribed an improved diet, sunlight, and exercise, but all I wanted was to sleep, and when I was not sleeping, I was somnambulant and silent, except for when the commandant came. "Is he still not saying anything?" the commandant asked whenever he dropped by, to which I said, "Nothing, nothing, nothing," a grinning simpleton huddled in the corner. "Poor fellow," said the doctor. "He is a little, how shall we say, discombobulated after his experiences." "Well, do something about it," cried the commandant. "I'll do my best, but it's all in his mind," the doctor said, pointing at my bruised forehead. The doctor was only half right. It was certainly all in my mind, but which one? Eventually, however, the doctor did hit on the treatment that put me on the slow road to recovery, its end, the reunification of me with myself. "Perhaps," he said one day, sitting on a chair next to me as I huddled in the corner, arms folded and head resting on them, "a familiar activity might help you." I peered at him with one eye. "Before your examination began, your days were occupied by writing your confession. Your state of mind is such that I don't think you can write anything now, but perhaps just going through the motions may help." I peered at him with both eyes. From his briefcase he extracted a thick stack of paper. "Does this look familiar?" Cautiously I unfolded my arms and took the stack. I looked at the first stage, then the second, and the third, slowly thumbing my way through the numbered sheaf of 295 pages. "What do you think that is?" said the doctor. "My confession," I muttered. "Exactly, dear fellow. Very good. Now, what I want you to do is to copy this confession." Out came another stack of paper from his briefcase, as well as a handful of pens. "Word for word. Can you do that for me?" I nodded slowly. He left me alone with my two stacks of paper, and for a very long time, it must have been hours, I stared at the first blank page, pen in trembling hand. Then I began, my tongue between my lips. At first I could copy only a few words an hour, then a page an hour, and then a few pages an hour. My drool dotted the pages as I saw my entire life unfold, over the months it took me to copy the confession. Gradually, as my bruised forehead healed, and as I absorbed my own words, I developed a growing sympathy for the man in these pages, the intelligence operative of doubtful intelligence. Was he a fool or too smart for his own good? Had he chosen the right side or the wrong side of history? And were not these the questions we should all ask ourselves? Or was it only me and myself who should be so concerned? By the time I finished copying my confession, enough of my senses had returned to me to understand that the answers were not to be found in those pages. When the doctor next came to examine me, I asked for a favor. "What is it, dear fellow?" "More paper, doctor, more paper." I explained that I wanted to write the story of those events that had happened after my confession, in the interminable time of my examination. So he brought me more paper, and I wrote new pages about what had been done to me in the examination room. I felt very sorry for the man with two minds, as would be expected. He had not realized that such a man best belonged in a low-budget movie, a Hollywood film, or perhaps a Japanese one, about a military-grade science experiment gone terribly awry. How dare a man with two minds think he could represent himself, much less anyone else, including his own recalcitrant people? They would never, in the end, be representable at all, regardless of what their representatives claimed. But as the pages mounted, I felt something else that surprised me. Sympathy for the man who did those things to me. Would he, my friend, not also be tortured by the things he had done to me? I was certain he would be by the time I finished writing, by the time I concluded with me screaming that one awful word into the bright shining light. All that remained after the certainty was to ask the doctor to let me see the commissar once more. "That is a very good idea," the doctor said, patting the pages of my manuscript and nodding with satisfaction. "You are nearly done, my boy. You are nearly done." I had not seen the commissar since the examination's conclusion. He had left me alone to begin my recovery, and I can only think that it was because he, too, was conflicted over what he had done to me, even though what was done to me had to be done, for I had to come to the answer myself. No one could tell me the solution to his riddle, not even him. All he could do was speed up my re-education through the regrettable method of pain. Having used such a method, he was reluctant to see me again, reasonably expecting my hatred. Meeting him in his quarters for our next and last meeting, I could see that he was uneasy, offering me tea, tapping his fingers on his knees, studying the new pages I had written. What do a torturer and the tortured say to each other after their climax has passed? I did not know, but as I sat watching him from my bamboo chair, still bisected into myself and another, I detected a similar division in him, in the horrible void where a face had been. He was the commissar, but he was also man. He was my interrogator, but also my only confidant. He was the fiend who had tortured me, but also my friend. Some might say I was seeing things, but the true optical illusion was in seeing others and oneself as undivided and whole, as if being in focus was more real than being out of focus. We thought our reflection in the mirror was who we truly were, when how we saw ourselves and how others saw us was often not the same. Likewise, we often deceive ourselves when we thought we saw ourselves most clearly. And how did I know that I was not deluding myself as I heard my friend speak? I do not. I could only try to understand whether he was fooling me as he skipped the pleasantries of inquiring about my dubious health, physical and mental, and announced that Bon and I were leaving both camp and country. I had assumed that I would die here, and the finality of what he was saying startled me. "Leave?" I said. "How?" "A truck is waiting for you and Bon at the gates. When I heard you were ready to see me, I wanted to waste no more time. You are going to Saigon. Bon has a cousin there who I am sure he will contact. This man has already tried twice to flee from this country, and had been caught both times. This third time, with you and Bon, he will succeed." His plan left me in a daze. "How do you know that?" I said at last. "How do I know?" His void was without expression, but his voice was amused and perhaps bitter. "Because I bought your escape. I've sent money to the right officials, who will make sure the right police officers look the other way when the time comes. Do you know where the money comes from?" I had no idea. Desperate women will pay any price to see their husbands in this camp. The guards take their portion and leave the rest to the commandant and myself. I sent some home to my wife. I pay my tithe to my superiors, and I use the remainder for your escape. Isn't it remarkable that in a communist country, money can still buy you anything you want? It's not remarkable, I muttered. It's funny. Is it? I can't say I laughed in taking the money and gold from these poor women. But you see, while a confession may be enough to free you from this camp, given your revolutionary background, nothing less than money will free Bonn. The commandant must be paid, after all. A considerable sum, too, given Bonn's crimes. And nothing less than a great deal of money will ensure that the two of you can leave our country, as you must. This, my friend, is what I have done to these women out of friendship for you. Am I still the friend you recognize and love? He was the faceless man who had tortured me, for my own good, for the sake of nothing. But I could still recognize him, for who but a man with two minds could understand a man with no face? I embraced him then, and wept, knowing that while he was setting me free, he himself could never be free, unable or unwilling to leave this camp, except through death, which at least would be a relief from his living death. The only benefit from his condition was that he could see what others could not, or what they might have seen and disavowed. For when he looked into the mirror and saw the void, he understood the meaning of nothing. But what was this meaning? What had I intuited at last? Namely this, while nothing is more precious than independence and freedom, nothing is also more precious than independence and freedom. These two slogans are almost the same, but not quite. The first inspiring slogan was Ho Chi Minh's empty suit, which he no longer wore. How could he? He was dead. The second slogan was the tricky one, the joke. It was Uncle Ho's empty suit turned inside out, a sartorial sensation that only a man of two minds, or a man with no face, dared to wear. This odd suit suited me, for it was of a cutting-edge cut. Wearing this inside-out suit, my seams exposed in an unseemly way, I understood, at last, how our revolution had gone from being the vanguard of political change to the rear guard hoarding power. In this transformation, we were not unusual. Hadn't the French and the Americans done exactly the same? Once revolutionaries themselves, they had become imperialists, colonizing and occupying our defiant little land, taking away our freedom in the name of saving us. Our revolution took considerably longer than theirs, and was considerably bloodier, but we made up for lost time. When it came to learning the worst habits of our French masters and their American replacements, we quickly proved ourselves the best. We, too, could abuse grand ideals. Having liberated ourselves in the name of independence and freedom, I was so tired of saying these words, we then deprived our defeated brethren of the same. Besides a man with no face, only a man with two minds could get this joke, about how a revolution fought for independence and freedom could make those things worth less than nothing. I was that man of two minds, me and myself. We had been through so much, me and myself. Everyone we met had wanted to drive us apart from each other, wanted us to choose either one thing or another, except the Commissar. He showed us his hand and we showed him ours, the red scars as indelible as they were in our youth. Even after all we had been through, this was the only mark on our body. We clasped hands and he said, "Before you leave, I have something to give you." From beneath his desk he retrieved our battered rucksack and our copy of Asian Communism and the Oriental Mode of Destruction. The last we had seen it, the book was nearly falling apart, creased deeply at the spine. The binding had finally torn apart, and a rubber band bound the book's two halves. We tried to refuse it, but he slipped the book into the rucksack and pressed it on us. "In case you ever need to send me a message," he said, "or vice versa. I still have my copy." Reluctantly, we took the rucksack. "Dear friend, one more thing." He picked up our manuscript, the copy of our confession and everything after, and motioned for us to open the rucksack. "What happened in that examination room is between us, so take this with you, too. We just want you to know. Go! Bonn is waiting." So we went, rucksack over our shoulders, dismissed for the last time. No more pencils, no more books, no more teachers' dirty looks. Silly rhymes and childish wordplay. But if we had thought of anything more serious, we would have fallen down under the weight of disbelief, of our sheer relief. The baby-faced guard escorted us to the camp gates, where the commandant and Bon stood by an idling Molotov truck. We had not seen Bon in a year and many months, and the first words he said were, "You look like hell." Us. What about him? Our disembodied minds laughed, but our embodied selves did not. How could we? Our poor friend stumbled before us in patchwork and rags, a puppet in an alcoholic's hands, hair thinning and skin a sickly shade of decayed jungle vegetation. Over one eye he wore a black patch, and we knew better than to ask him what had been done to him. A few meters away, behind barbed wire, three other haggard men in shambolic clothing watched. It took us a moment to recognize our comrades, the Hmong scout, the philosophical medic, and the dark marine. "You don't look like hell," the Hmong scout said. "You look worse." The philosophical medic managed a grin with half his teeth missing. "Don't pay him any attention," he said. "He's just jealous." As for the dark marine, he said, "I knew you bastards would get out of here first. Good luck to you." We couldn't say anything, only smile and raise our hand in farewell, before climbing into the truck with Bon. The baby-faced guard raised the hatch and locked it. "What?" the commandant said, looking up at us. "You still have nothing to say?" In fact, we had many things to say, but not wanting to provoke the commandant into revoking our release, we only shook our head. "Have it your way. You've confessed your errors. There's nothing more to say after that, is there?" Nothing indeed. Nothing was truly unspeakable. As the truck departed in a cloud of red dust that made the baby-faced guard cough, we watched the commandant walk away, and the Hmong scout, the philosophic medic, and the dark marine cover their eyes. Then we turned a corner, and the camp disappeared from view. When we asked Bon about our other comrades, he told us that the Lao farmer had vanished in the river, trying to escape, while the darkest marine bled to death after a landmine sheared off his legs. At first we were quiet on hearing this news. What cause had they died for? For what reason had millions more died in our great war, to unify our country and liberate ourselves, often through no choice of their own? Like them, we had sacrificed everything, but at least we still had a sense of humor. If one really thought about it, with just a little bit of distance, with even the faintest sense of irony, one could laugh at this joke played on us, those who had so willingly sacrificed ourselves and others. So we laughed, and laughed, and laughed, and when Bon looked at us as if we were crazy and asked what was the matter with us, we wiped the tears from our eyes and said, "Nothing." After a numbing 2-day journey over mountain passes and crumbling highways, the Molotova deposited us on Saigon's outskirts. From there, we shuffled along sullied streets populated by sullen people toward the navigator's house, our pace slowed by Bond's limp. The muffled city was eerily muted, perhaps because the country was once again at war, or so we were told by the Molotova's driver. Tired of the Khmer Rouge attacks on our western border, we had invaded and seized Cambodia. China, to punish us, had raided our northern border earlier this year, sometime during my examination. So much for peace. What bothered us more was that we had not heard even one romantic song or snatch of pop music by the time we arrived at the home of the navigator, Bond's cousin. Sidewalk cafes and transistor radios had always played such tunes, but over a dinner only marginally better than the commandant's meal, the navigator confirmed what the commandant had implied. Yellow music was now banned, and only red, revolutionary music was allowed. No yellow music in a land of so-called yellow people? Not having fought for this, we could not help but laugh. The navigator looked at us curiously. "I've seen worse," he said. "Two stints in re-education, and I've seen much worse." He had been re-educated for the crime of trying to escape the country by boat. On those previous attempts, he had not taken his family with him, hoping to brave the dangers alone and reach a foreign country from where he could send money home to help his family survive or flee once the route was proven safe. But he was certain that a third capture would lead to re-education in a northern camp, from which no one had so far returned. For this attempt, then, he was taking his wife, three sons and their families, two daughters and their families, and the families of three in-laws, the clan living or dying together on the open sea. "What are the odds?" Vaughn asked the navigator, an experienced sailor of the old regime, whose expertise Vaughn trusted. 50-50, the navigator said. "I've only heard from half of those who fled. It's safe to assume that the other half never made it." Vaughn shrugged. "Sounds good enough," he said. "What do you think?" This was addressed to us. We looked at the ceiling, where Sonny and the crapulent major lay flat on their backs, scaring away the geckos. In unison, as they were wont now to speak, they said, "Those are excellent odds, as the chances of one ultimately dying are 100%. Thus reassured, we turned back to Bond and the navigator, and with no more laughter, nodded our agreement. This they interpreted as a sign of progress. Over the next 2 months, as we waited for our departure, we continued working on our manuscript. Despite the chronic shortages of almost every good and commodity, there was no shortage of paper, since everyone in the neighborhood was required to write confessions on a periodic basis. Even we, who had confessed so extensively, had to write these and submit them to the local cadres. They were exercises in fiction, for we had to find things to confess, even though we had not done anything since our return to Saigon. Small things, like failing to display sufficient enthusiasm at a self-criticism session, were acceptable, but certainly nothing big, and we never failed to end the confession without writing that nothing was more precious than independence and freedom. Now it is the evening of our departure. We have paid for Bond's fare and our own with the Commissar's gold, hidden in my rucksack's false bottom. The cipher that we share with the Commissar had taken the gold's place, the heaviest thing we will carry after this manuscript, our testament if not our will. We have nothing to leave to anyone except these words, our best attempt to represent ourselves against all those who sought to represent us. Tomorrow, we will join those tens of thousands who have taken to the sea, refugees from a revolution. According to the navigator's plan, on the afternoon of our departure tomorrow, from houses all over Saigon, families will leave as if on a short trip lasting less than a day. We will travel by bus to a village 3 hours south, where a ferryman waits by a riverbank, a conical hat shading his features. "Can you take us to our uncle's funeral?" To this coded question, decoded answer, "Your uncle was a great man." We, along with the navigator, his wife, and Bon, clamber on board the skiff, we carrying in our rucksack our rubber-bound cipher and this unbound manuscript, wrapped in watertight plastic. We glide across the river to a hamlet where the rest of the navigator's clan will join us. The mother ship awaits down the river, a fishing trawler for 150, almost all of whom will hide in the hold. "It will be hot," warned the navigator. "It reeks." Once the crew battens down the hatches of the hold, we will struggle to breathe, no vents to alleviate the pressure from 150 bodies, locked into a space for a third that number. Heavier than depleted air, however, is the knowledge that even astronauts have a better chance of survival than we do. Around our shoulders and chest, we will strap the rucksack, cipher, and manuscript inside. Whether we live or die, the weight of those words will hang on us. Only a few more need to be written by the light of this oil lamp. Having answered the Commissar's question, we find ourselves facing more questions, universal and timeless ones, that never get tired. What do those who struggle against power do when they seize power? What does the revolutionary do when the revolution triumphs? Why do those who call for independence and freedom take away the independence and freedom of others? And is it sane or insane to believe, as so many around us apparently do, in nothing? We can only answer these questions for ourselves. Our life and our death have taught us always to sympathize with the undesirables among the undesirables. Thus magnetized by experience, our compass continually points toward those who suffer. Even now, we think of our suffering friend, our blood brother, the Commissar, the faceless man, the one who spoke the unspeakable, sleeping his morphine dream, dreaming of an eternal sleep, or perhaps dreaming of nothing. As for us, how long had it taken us to stare at nothing until we saw something? Might this be what our mother felt? Did she look into herself and feel wonderstruck that where nothing had been, something now existed, namely us? Where was the turning point when she began wanting us rather than not wanting us? Seed of a father who should not have been a father? When did she stop thinking of herself and began thinking of us? Tomorrow we will find ourselves among strangers, reluctant mariners of whom a tentative manifest can be written. Among us will be infants and children, as well as adults and parents, but no elderly, for none dare the voyage. Among us will be men and women, as well as the thin and lean, but not one among us will be fat, the entire nation having undergone a forced diet. Among us will be the light-skinned, dark-skinned, and every shade in between, some speaking in refined accents and some in rough ones. Many will be Chinese, persecuted for being Chinese, with many others, the recipients of degrees in re-education. Collectively, we will be called the Boat People, a name we heard once more earlier this night when we surreptitiously listened to the Voice of America on the Navigator's radio. Now that we are counted among these Boat People, their name disturbs us. It smacks of anthropological condescension, evoking some forgotten branch of the human family, some lost tribe of amphibians emerging from ocean mist crowned with seaweed. But we are not primitives, and we are not to be pitied. If and when we reach safe harbor, it will hardly be a surprise if we, in turn, turn our backs on the unwanted, human nature being what we know of it. Yet we are not cynical. Despite it all, yes, despite everything, in the face of nothing, we still consider ourselves revolutionary. And we remain that most hopeful of creatures, a revolutionary in search of a revolution. Although we will not dispute being called a dreamer doped by an illusion. Soon enough, we will see the scarlet sunrise on that horizon, where the east is always red. But for now, our view through our window is of a dark alley, the pavement barren, the curtains closed. Surely we cannot be the only ones awake, even if we are the only ones with a single lamp lit. No, we cannot be alone. Thousands more must be staring into darkness like us, gripped by scandalous thoughts, extravagant hopes, and forbidden plots. We lie in wait for the right moment and the just cause, which at this moment is simply wanting to live. And even as we write this final sentence, the sentence that will not be revised, we confess to being certain of one and only one thing. We swear to keep, on penalty of death, this one promise. We will live. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Sympathizer, written by Viet Thanh Nguyen, narrated by Francois Chow. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright, 2015 by Viet Thanh Nguyen. Recorded by arrangement with Grove Atlantic, Inc. Production copyright 2015 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.